Hello, you're very welcome to Inside Education, the programme and podcast for teachers, policymakers, researchers and anyone with a stake in the future of teaching and learning. I'm Sean Delaney and you can download podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the podcasts tab. This week I bring you the second part of my interview with Ciarán Gray, a primary teacher with a passion for teaching and for dance. On last week's programme, Ciarán told us about dance education, where it fits in the curriculum, and about setting up Company B, a contemporary dance company exclusively for young males. This week, Ciarán talks more generally about his work as a teacher. But first I asked him how he became interested in dance education himself.
It's partly to do with being a big fish in a small sea, because I got interested in dance and I was doing jazz dance at first, and then I moved into contemporary dance. And when I'd been in college, we'd done a certain amount of dance, and I just was aware of there was a kind of a lack there. And the great thing was that Gay Tanham, who was involved in the Dance Council of Ireland many years back, she tended to send people my way. They got in touch with the Dance Council saying, you know, we want this sort of thing. And as a result, in 1988, all those years ago, I'd only been a few years teaching, but I decided to take a career break for a year and work on my own dance. And then, absolute amazing timing, Irish National Ballet, who had had their funding cut, and one of the reasons cited was that their dance and education programme wasn't up to scratch. So they said to the Arts Council, who should we get? And they said, that's not for us to say, contact the Dance Council. And they contacted the Dance Council, and Gay Tanham said, talk to Ciarán Gray. And they did. And so I found myself down in Cork, travelling around primary schools and secondary schools, doing a dance project, which is pretty much established. A lot of the methodology, just the simple methodologies that I use, and that was 1988-89. Strangely enough, having just gone to a conference in London, but I had been to a conference organised by Dance and the Child International in the summer of 88, I think it was, and I just saw practitioners from all around the world, all around the UK, but actually from all around the world, giving practical sessions. I tended to go along to the practical sessions and some kind of theory or some sort of, you know, discussions and that, but mostly to see practical sessions. And to this day, I can visualize certain little things that I saw that I went, yes, I think that's good. That'll become part of my practice. And other things have gone, oh yeah, that needs to be avoided. Like there was one piece that was, you know, done with great love by a group, I forget where they were from, but it was about Under the Sea, and it was long. And at the end of it, there were lots of sections. And at the end, somebody asked the person who had created it, said, why do all the fish move slowly? And it was a very diplomatic way of saying, you know, there were no dynamic changes in it. That conference then fed into, when I was working for Irish National Ballet, the theme that I did. And it was a year of an Olympic year, so the Olympics were just over. So I created a dance project based on the Olympics and divided it up into throwing sports, jumping sports. Basically had about four or five categories, ball sports. I had gone on, it wasn't the internet, it was pre-internet, so I had gone and photocopied photographs of people doing these various things and stuck them onto an A2-sized piece of paper. So each group got these pictures and then they would create movements. So that was really the beginning of it. That conference from Dance and the Child International into working for Irish National Ballet and creating a way of working. And then, as I say, Gay kind of pointed me towards people, and I found some books and some people I kind of went, yes, I like that.
And did it come naturally to you, or how did you develop your own ability at dance?
It kind of ties into what I was talking about earlier, is that, you know, I went to an all-male primary school, an all-male secondary school. I think it was a Friday afternoon in primary school, we used to go over to the assembly hall and do Irish dancing, which I really enjoyed. I really, really liked it. But that was it for dance off throughout my whole primary experience, with those Irish dancing classes. But I do remember, interestingly enough, that there was a teacher who was quite well-known, a man called Jack Barrett, who was principal out in Ashburn, I think, at one point. But he did a piece about Cú Chulainn and Feardia. And I remember seeing two boys from his class performing what was essentially a creative dance piece. And we're talking about 1968, 69, maybe 1970, you know. So that was pretty out there for 1970 in a boys' school in Larkhill in Dublin. But I went into secondary school, did all the sports. Hurling was my sport, and then basketball. Then into college, and I was doing drama. And drama was a big thing with me in college. And then for my final project, rather than doing a play, I decided to do a dance piece, which I performed in and which I choreographed. So it was the first time I'd ever choreographed anything. And I just sort of, I suppose it lit a little flame inside me. I went, yeah, this is what I want to do.
But you make it sound as if choreography is easy, whereas for me, it would be the most challenging thing I could take on.
It is funny that, because one of my lads who's been with me for not quite the whole 10 years, but last April, May.
This is in Company B.
This is in Company B. I gave them the chance to work on solos. So I would teach for an hour and a half, an hour and a quarter, and then we'd have a little break, and then they would have an hour and a half to work on their own solos. And I would try not to interfere, but offer a bit of advice. And he started making up a piece, and I was kind of conscious that he was floundering a little, that, you know, he was putting these interesting movements, but they weren't connecting or they weren't joining up. And he said to me, this is really hard. How have you done this for the last 9 years? You know, you make it look kind of easy. I said, I don't know, really. I suppose I'm always questioning myself. I'm always sort of saying, "Is just, am I just churning out the same old stuff again? And keeping an eye on myself. But I know there are certain types of movement that I lean towards. There's a certain movement vocabulary that I favour. So I kind of sometimes slap myself on the wrist to break myself, you know, away from it. But it was there inside me, and circumstances pleasantly brought me to it.
Of course, dance is just one of the many subjects you teach in primary school. Yeah. You teach a lot of other subjects. What other subjects do you enjoy teaching? I'd like to talk a little bit, I suppose, about how you approach your teaching in general.
I was bad at maths in primary school. It just didn't click. Where it clicked for other people, it didn't work for me. And strangely enough, it's probably one of the subjects I really enjoy teaching, because I have this thing of, well, I don't have a natural affinity with mathematics. So like, if something isn't making sense one way, then maybe coming at it another way. And maybe the creative side of me kind of likes to find other angles to come at things. And I find it really satisfying sometimes when you hear the penny drop. It's kind of a running joke in the class. Somebody will go, oh, and we'll say, oh, can we hear that penny drop? You know, and it's sort of a class thing that we do sometimes. Sometimes with a joke, sometimes with an idea. People go, oh. So I like teaching maths. I don't know if I'm good at it, but it's certainly something I do. But I suppose English would be my big thing. I absolutely adore language. I adore words, and enriching children's vocabulary is just a real mission with me, a mission and a passion. And I have a column just up on the whiteboard where words that come up in the course of teaching, they go up there, and I revisit them occasionally. Then when the column is sort of full, then there's a website I use to create a crossword and to see if we can consolidate their understanding and their use of that. But I've had people come in and say, what class is this? How come you're teaching them that word? You're teaching them that word. And it is interesting because, so I have all these crosswords from previous years, but I actually can't use them with the next year's class unless those words have organically been generated in the course of teaching. And some of them, like, because I've taught fifth class in particular a lot, some of them will crop up, but there'll be other words in there that haven't come up in lessons. So it'd be artificial to start sort of saying, well, here's a word you should know. I think if they come up in a context, and if a week later say, okay, do we remember this word? There'll be blank faces, and then somebody say, oh, and I might be able to say it was in the context of, or, you know, it was connected with, and people start to make those little connections again, and it'll have a contextual meaning, which is pretty essential.
Are there any particular projects you've worked on this year or last year with your students?
I think project work, children working on projects, is a good thing, but I have a certain phobia for certain aspects of project work. I have this memory of, like, when I was given projects in school, that you bought a scrapbook, and then you got, you know, your thing of glue, and you glued in pages. And one of the great mysteries is that there seems to be this unwritten law that you don't write on lined paper, that you get blank paper and then draw in lines with a pencil badly and then write on those. So I tend to rant on those subjects a bit. But I'm really interested in moving towards things like podcasts and moving towards using technology, and I'm a huge fan of Google Docs. So like, my hat class have a few folders. There's one for their creative writing. Like, we do a creative writing compilation four times a year: Halloween, Christmas, Easter, and summer. So they handwrite their first draft, and then they type it up and it's all editable, and I can sort of conference with them online sort of with how the stories are open in front of them. But for projects it's the same. And last year we did one that I really liked, actually I've done it twice now, was in geography, doing an A to Z of Britain when we were studying Great Britain. And it's in the window on the world as a suggestion. I went, oh, hold on, I like that. So I broke the alphabet up into get each a few letters assigned to each group or a table and that in the class. And they had to do something to do with Britain on that. I put a little folder or a little table in their thing, so it had their name and then which letter they were doing. And then I was able to compile all of those into one PDF, and the formatting was the same on them all. So we had our personalized A to Z of Britain, which is online on the class page, and it looks nice. You know, there's an integrity, or there's a consistency to the format and to the look of it and the approach. They managed to stretch what letters they did. I like moving towards this thing, and they're doing one on now inventors who improved communication in the world. We're doing a chapter in history on communication. In the book they have Morse and Logie Baird and Graham Bell and that. So they can take one of those, but then they have to find another inventor or somebody who improved or helped the whole thing of communication, you know. And a few years ago came up with Heidi Lamarr, the actress who was big into cryptology. And she developed a very interesting kind of method of encrypting things during the Second World War. So they're doing that. And rather than, say, feeding back to the classroom, then I have a simple program on the school MacBook that they can record their podcast version of their project, which could be a voiceover to go with the visuals to do with their project.
And when you say conferencing that with them on their writing, what does that conferencing involve?
Well, I went to a fantastic conference a few years ago here. Many years ago, Donald Graves, and it was organised by the Reading Association of Ireland. Oh, it was just so inspirational. It was great. And then you go back to the classroom and you realise, the reality is that English is just this little finite, very finite period of time in the day, and finding the time, first of all, inspiring or coaxing or whatever the children to finish their first draft, and then reading it and then feeding back to them and getting them to do a second draft. And like when I first started teaching in my school, it was all second drafts and third, everything was done on paper. So now we have the facility to type, and then it makes editing so much easier. The reality is it's so hard to find in the school day the time to sort of say to a child, come here, let's talk about your story. I think this is good. This would be better if this idea were left out and you could develop that idea. When I do get to do it, I'm thrilled, but it's so hard to do. Whereas when I read through them using Google Docs, it has the facility to highlight words and then to leave little notes down the side. And then when they look at those, they can either reply or they can click resolve, that they have resolved what the issue was or what the thing was. That's kind of the lip service that we pay to sort of like, you know, interacting with them about their work. But at least you can highlight a whole passage and say, this doesn't need to be here, or this is the interesting idea you should be working on, you know.
And do you have a separate Google Doc for every child, or who do they share it with?
As the administrator, I own all of the documents, which means that if any mischievous person were to go in and alter them, there's revision history, so you can take it back to a previous version which wasn't altered. Or if every once in a while somebody goes, I just did something and the whole story's gone and they've deleted it, and that, you know, so you can go back to wherever it was. So I create all these folders, and there's one, as I say, for scribbles, our creative writing paper, and then there's one for projects, and there was one for a poetry writing. And they go in there, and I share them with them. And they go in, and then inside the folder is a file with each of their names, and they can go in there and type their story. Now, there are potential disadvantages, but we've had very little interference and very little kind of divilry. You know, there is a chat function, but I've never really sort of found that useful.
You mentioned scribbles.
Well, as I said, I love words. So when I had fourth class, the creative writing magazine was called Forthright, which I really liked. But then when I had fifth or third, that didn't work so well. So one of the years I settled on Scribbles, and it stayed as Scribbles now. So it's been Scribbles for about 15 years.
And is that published, or what do you do with it?
I compile the stories that they have written. I mean, it takes a long time. There's a few hours work in it each edition. I print up a copy in black and white for everybody in the class. But I also do a PDF version, which then goes on the website.
Who or what inspires you?
Looking back, I think there are teachers that I had in the past that I've tried, or I would feel I'm continuing certain qualities of their teaching aspect, of their style, of the atmosphere that they created in the class. In terms of teaching, I can't think of any one person, you know.
There would be people who taught you in primary or post-primary.
Yeah. I had this wonderful science teacher in St. Aidan's in Whitehall, Milo Connolly, and he was just a lovely teacher. I had him just up to intercert. He did this thing when we were in second year, whereby we had a double science period, and he said, for the second period, if anybody would like to give a talk on a science topic, you know, you could do it and then do a question and answer session. And just something in me went, oh, I quite like that. And I was very interested in animals at the time, sort of wildlife and sort of, you know. So I thought, I'm going to do that. So I prepared my little lesson and I stood up and gave a lecture to the class on senses in the animal kingdom. That's what it was. And then
senses, S-E-N-S-E-S.
Yes, yeah. the five senses, yeah. But so I did on that and did a Q&A session, and I just thought, this feels right. I really like this, you know. And then many moons later, we were involved in supporting a program for training science teachers that was happening in DCU, and one of the people involved in our school was involved. So we were taking student teachers out who were going to be secondary school teachers, but they were only 18, 19, so we're letting them have their first teaching practice in primary school rather than secondary. So we were invited to lunch, and I went along to the lunch, and there was this white-haired man, sort of like, and I ended up sitting beside him, and he turned around and went, "How are you? My name's Milo Connolly." And I went, "Oh my gosh." I said, "Milo, you are one of the main reasons that I'm a teacher." And he went, "Really?" I said, "Yeah." I said, and I told him about that. And at that stage, he was 64, and he was sort of saying, he said, "Oh, that's it. That's really good. I don't remember doing that. I must do that again. That's a really nice idea, you know." And he was going to be compulsory retirement at 65, and he was planning on fighting it because he was still enjoying teaching. And it showed, you know, and we enjoyed being taught by him. I was really glad to be able to tell him and say thanks.
Very often we don't have the opportunity to thank those teachers who inspired us.
Yeah, I had a great teacher in primary school, Tom Quinn, and it was the days when you had the same teacher for years and years. So I think I did junior and senior infants in what we called the convent school, in the nuns we called it, and then we went over to the masters, and I had Mrs. Kennedy, Miss O'Shea for first and second. So I probably had him from third, fourth, fifth. I had him for 4 years, if not 5 years in a row, which is a long time. But it was fine because he was great. You know, I was lucky. I really enjoyed my primary school. And I went back and did teaching practice in his classroom, which was weird because it was only about 6 or 7 years later, which, you know, I would have thought was a lot at the time, but actually isn't. So I suppose teachers had a big influence.
Have you a favourite book or blog or writer about education?
No, I don't really. Every once in a while, I just sort of find an article or something that would just grab my attention, but there's nobody that I would consistently look to. I did read an article a few years ago which had a big impact. I'm very much into the idea of stimulating thought and debate and the whole idea of philosophy as sort of, you know, teasing out ideas. I use a book called The Little Book of Tunks for philosophy in school, and there are just these little questions, you throw them out, and then people start to answer with great firmness, and then you tweak and say, but what if? But this was a really interesting article which put forward the idea, well, maybe there's a danger there that if children feel that everything is up for discussion, maybe they're missing out on the fact that there are maybe some moral laws or some things that actually need to be stated as, actually, this is the right thing. You know, that sometimes, despite all the discussion, you need to be able to say, but this is what we should be aiming for in a moral world and in an ideal world. And actually, sometimes it's good to spell it out. I can't remember the name of the article. It was from an educational magazine, and it really stopped me. So that's become part of my teaching practice, which was discuss away, but every once in a while put a little marker or wave a little banner and say, this is the line that you should be aiming for.
And that book, The Little Book of Tunks,
yeah.
Do you know who that's by?
I have a look here. I have it on my iPad. It's just fantastic as a thought provoker. Like the one we did for a little philosophy session last week was, can being sad be pleasurable? Can it be pleasure being sad, you know? And the kids straight away, they just sort of took to it, you know, they just went, oh, great. And then they talked about, like, well, how if you're feeling sad, people will be nice to you, and people, you know, so you might want to fake it a little bit. Ian Gilbert, 260 questions to make your brain go ouch. And it's from the Independent Thinking series. Could a computer ever be happy? Is it possible that our universe is contained in a speck of dust on the back of a large goat? They throw open sort of things of morality. Big questions couched in amusing or quirky terms.
If you could make one change to your current school and resources were not an issue, What change would you make?
It would probably make me the most unpopular person in the world, but I think it would be to make the school day a bit longer. Says he, with maybe another 4 or 5 years left of his teaching career. But it just feels a lot of the time that that's, we're trying to cram a lot of stuff into a very short period. And when I was in college, I went over to visit an École Normale in Brittany for a few weeks. And you just did have this sense of, because the day was so long, and that, you know, they went to lunchtime and they took a proper lunch and then they had an afternoon. It was long. But there didn't seem to be that sense of just trying to get jump from subject to subject. And I remember shortly after beginning teaching, talking to people who'd been in college with me and saying, oh, well, you know, like I just watch the clock and once it 20 minutes, you know, clink, right, change subject, blah, change subject, you know. And I have never, ever done that in my life. Like, time management is one of my biggest challenges. But interestingly, coming full circle, back to that Reading Association of Ireland conference, it's great. He got us to do bits of creative writing, you know, on the spot, and really enjoyed it. And I, at one point, ended up writing a little piece, and then you would share it with whoever you were sitting beside. This woman sort of said, I'm not a teacher, I'm involved in publishing children's books and that. She said, but she said, you're the third or fourth teacher that I have done one of these exercises with on this conference, she said, and every single one of them have written about time. And I thought, yeah, it's sort of, you know, an obsession.
And how much longer would the school day need to be?
Well, since we're in hypothetical land, I suppose 4 o'clock would probably be a good finishing time, sort of similar to secondary schools. I think there would be huge outrage if it were ever suggested, but I think it would take away some of that sense of, you know.
And would you lengthen the breaks as well?
You might need but I mean, half an hour for lunch is, like, it's one of the big luxuries whenever you go, you know, when you're on holidays or when you're doing, say, an in-service day and you actually have, like, 45 to an hour to have your lunch, like, oh wow. Because the reality is, when you're teaching, you have a half hour break, but by the time you get the children to the yard, and then if somebody is sick and needs to be looked after, or if there's anything delayed, you get a phone call or something like that, you know, you find yourself sitting down to the table sometimes with 12 to 15 minutes to have your lunch, and you just have this feeling of trying to catch yourself up. And what it does is it engenders a sense of, maybe not failure, but just constantly feet like a swan, frantically going under the water.
And finally, and we've touched on this before, but what from your own primary or post-primary education informs your practice in education today?
Well, I suppose it comes back a little bit to the teachers. I watched a documentary there recently on Jacques Peretti on billion-dollar deals that changed our lives or something like that. And he was looking at the way business are reshaping education in America, particularly, you know, and how technology is. And it showed a place, I forget what state it was in, but essentially you had 75 second level students in a room, each of them sitting at a computer terminal. And it was one person managing the whole session, and he would sort of say a few kind of inspiring words, and then they would all turn to their terminals. And then the camera and crew went around, and you would say, well, this student is working on astronomy here, and this one's working on calculus. So they're working on different things side by side, you know, and the students are choosing what they want to study and what they're working on. That, I was kind of going, yeah. And then they had a really sort of staged kind of, you know, staff meeting. They had lots of readouts and sort of graphs and things of performance levels. And now this girl here, she's sort of, you know, we have two red blocks here, so she hasn't completed this assignment. So we'll need to send an email to her parents about that. And I just thought, yeah, it'll work for those that are motivated. But for those, you know, who need a personal input. I love technology. I love incorporating it in. I use it as much as I can. We're a digital school. We have that accolade, whatever it is. But my primary school teacher, Tom Quinn, Milo Connolly, and a few other teachers I had in secondary school, they're the ones that stick with me. And how you felt about their subject depended on the atmosphere, the environment. And I know that, you know, I know that I'm continuing that, because even the other night at the AGM of our school, one parent was telling me about things that her son is talking about at the dinner table, you know, and I said, oh, sorry for that. And she went, no, she said, that's fantastic. And I've heard that because my interests are so wide and varied and I get excited about everything. I get feedback is that, you know, kids go home and they say, we were talking about this today and we were talking about this, and they talk about it. What we talk about in class, and they get excited about it. And I think teachers do that.
So is that where the motivation comes from then? Your own interest is motivating the children?
At times I've seen things and I feel that there's potential there for teachers to be managers who manage educational activities in a class. And I don't think that's teaching. I think teaching is about inspiring and exciting and drawing, oh, what's that great word, a Duco drawing out, you know, that, that you poke and you rummage in their interest and you find angles on things. And the image I use all the time is I try to get children to peep through windows and say, what about that? Is that interesting? And they might think, no, and then they might go, oh. Or they might later on go, oh, I remember doing that, you know. So I think teachers can do that. There's such a proliferation of information available now that there's a danger of people falling into patterns of listening. Actually, it was interesting that they were saying that people's listening to music has become very idiosyncratic, that, you know, whereas before you would sometimes listen to the radio and you would be offered different things. And that's why I like listening to the radio. I listen to, it has to be said, lyric, but you do get world music and you get jazz and you get classical and that. And I've heard pieces of music that I never would have heard if I was just left with my iPad or iTunes or whatever listener. I would just probably just stick to the things that I like. Whereas when somebody is there to offer you things that you just don't know about, then your potential to grow is greater. So maybe that's it. Maybe that's what teachers do, is that they offer you the chance to be interested in things that you didn't know about and now suddenly find that you are.
And that reflection on what teachers bring to children's lives in a digital mass communication era comes from primary teacher Kieran Gray, and it brings this week's Inside Education to a close. Kieran is an expert on dance education, and to hear more about that, you can listen to last week's programme. If you'd like to download that programme or to choose from the 300 other previous editions of Inside Education podcasts, go to seandelaney.com and click on the podcasts tab. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from all good online bookshops and from local libraries. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.